All right, thanks, Tim. Tim Carpenter. All righty. Wow. Gonna see you all. Oh, this is much better. I cannot believe that I'm forced to do the Ted Kennedy thing. Right? And you are Massachusetts citizens, so you know. Back in 1972, I was driven by my mom and dad from our rural little town of Union Grove into Kenosha, Wisconsin, to the United Auto Workers Local 72 Hall to see Ted Kennedy speak. And, you know, Kenosha is a Catholic, Union, Democratic town. And so when Ted Kennedy came to speak in 1972, it was a little bit like, you know, waters parted. It was someplace, everybody was there. 7,000 people came out to see Ted Kennedy, and in a great triumph of the labor struggle, the microphone didn't work. And Ted Kennedy got up on a chair, and he filled the entire United Auto Workers Hall with that incredible voice. So I will do my best Kennedy for you today. And I'm so honored to be with you. I'm so honored to be also with our members of Congress. Do not miss the point that in this great struggle that we are involved with right now, this struggle to define whether the United States will be a nation of economic and social justice and peace, or whether we will be a nation that is an insult not merely to our hopes and dreams, but also to the vision of the founders of this republic. That's the struggle we're in. And those members of Congress and those members of your state legislature who are willing to stand up right now and say no to the wrecking crews, these are American heroes. They are American heroes, and they are with us today. Do not underestimate that. Now, so too is anyone who's come to knit. Fantastic. Look at you, Granny Peace Brigade. So I'm going to take a couple minutes up front to tell you a little bit about Wisconsin, because I love to do so. I see this lovely woman. Will you stand up and show them your T-shirt? Look at her. There you go. She's got her shirt. Yeah, the fist in the shape of Wisconsin, right? This is Door County up here, right? And I'm from down right about here. Madison's over here. And it really is one big fist, all raised up. From top to bottom, every county, every village, people shouting solidarity with our public employee unions and saying, you're not going to break our unions. I don't want think tanks in Washington telling us that this state is in bad financial shape because we got people who take care of our mentally disabled kids, and we got snowplow drivers, and we got teachers. No way. That's wrong. That is fundamentally wrong. But that's what Scott Walker, our governor, did. And I want to tell you just how stupid I am. I am as dumb as they come. There's nobody stupider than me. Because when Scott Walker announced his plan on February 12th, just not that long ago, on February 12th, when he announced his plan, I was sitting in a restaurant that night with a friend of mine who's the former chair of the Joint Finance Committee of the Wisconsin Legislature and a couple other friends who are big political players, smart. So we had so much political punditry in that room, you couldn't even breathe. And you know, we all sat around, we said, well, Walker, put this plan down. The Democrats are on their heels. There's nothing going on with them. The labor movement is, you know, it's just sucked the life out of it. They've deindustrialized our private sector. The public sector has been beaten down. We've got no National Nurses Association to speak of in our state. And, you know, we just don't have it. We don't have the muscle to do this. And so the best we can hope for is maybe if we plead with him, he won't beat us too hard. And we all accepted, this is it. And my friend had been over at the labor hall, at the AFSCME hall that afternoon. I said, well, how are people doing? He said, they're in shock. They're just, you know, because Walker has announced he's taken away their collective bargaining rights. He's taken away their dues collection. He's going to take away their ability to be functional unions. And he's going to do it not to balance a budget. They had just given away $150 million in tax cuts for multinational corporations 2 weeks before. So it wasn't about money. He was breaking the unions because in Wisconsin, as in so many other states, public employee unions are the only force that goes into our political process in the face of the Citizens United ruling, which allows corporations to spend whatever they can. It's public employee unions that are the sole force that can go in there and say, no, we ought to defend public services, we ought to defend public education. And so if you shut them down, you shut down a democratic discourse. And that's what was happening. The governor was on the roll. He had a majority in both houses of the legislature. He had the bully pulpit, and we were doomed. And so, being the brilliant pundits that we were, we gave up, had another drink, and headed on home. Unfortunately, for our brilliant punditry, someone forgot to tell the teaching assistants, the students at the University of Wisconsin. They weren't as smart as us. They didn't know that they weren't supposed to fight this thing. And so on that cold Saturday morning, February 13th, 50 teaching assistants came out in front of the University of Wisconsin Student Union with signs handmade that said, "This shall not pass. We're not going to let this law go into effect." And they stood there and nothing happened. And so 2 days later, 1,000 of them made Valentines on February 14th, and they marched from the university to the Capitol to give the governor Valentines and say, "Don't break our heart." And nothing happened. But the next day, we had a rally at the Capitol, and the students had come, and a few more people thought, "Well, what the heck? It's Madison. Let's have a rally." And amazingly enough, that night I looked out off that stage, 8,000 people had showed up. They had seen the students come and they said, "Well, I guess I'll stand with those kids. And you know, we're going to lose, we're doomed, we don't have a chance, but let's go out and do it." 8,000 people came to that rally. And that night as I was going up to speak, there was a guy standing next to me, an aging public employee, and he had a little sign that said, it was in Arabic, and I apologize for not speaking Arabic. And I said, "What does your sign say, sir?" And he said, "It says, if Egypt could stop Mubarak, Wisconsin can stop Walker." I'm often asked if this movement was influenced at all by events in the Middle East and Egypt. I always respond that my favorite sign for the movement to this day, it was a handmade one of a guy walking down the street in the middle of a snowstorm that read, "I thought Cairo would be warmer." So we had this rally, and my friend John Matthews, the head of the Madison Teachers Incorporated, our teachers union in Madison, saw this and he said, "You know what? I think the teachers are going to have an in-service day at the Capitol." And so that night they gathered the teachers together, and the teachers decided that they were going to walk off the job the next day from every school in Madison, thousands of teachers and teaching assistants, and go to the Capitol to lobby against the bill, the first big union to pull out. And I'm driving up to the Capitol that day, and I thought to myself, "Well, this is getting interesting. Even Michael Eddy might like this. This is getting a little labor action here." But yeah, I wasn't expecting much. I'm going up to the Capitol, and there was a traffic jam. I was having trouble getting to the Capitol. That doesn't happen often in Madison. We're a relatively Northampton kind of town. Although I noticed a traffic jam here coming to this lovely event. And might have been the concert 2 doors down. But so I'm driving up the street, and I'm like, what's ahead of me? Why am I not moving at my usual rate? And as I got closer to the Capitol, about 4 blocks out, I saw 2,000 high school students who had walked out in solidarity with their teachers, marching 4 miles from East High School to the Capitol. And when I got to the Capitol, I saw 2,000 students who had walked 2 miles from the West Side coming in, from the West Side High School. And then a few minutes later, 6,000 30,000 University of Wisconsin students marched in wearing the red and white colors of our state, chanting, "Walker won't win." And I looked at that and I said, well, I am sticking around for this. And let me just tell you, it has grown and grown and grown because we did take the lesson of Egypt, which is a great lesson that the left forgot about. We thought Martin King was a great, great visionary, and he said, well, let's go to Washington in 1963. We'll have a big rally on August 28th, and then we'll get civil rights. And it worked, right? So we thought, okay, big rally. That works. The other guys figured that out. They figured out, okay, big rally, not enough. Well, we took that lesson from Egypt and from Tunisia and from other parts of the world, and we kept coming back again and again and again. And so on that Thursday, and I promise I'm not taking you through all 55 days, because we've got some wonderful people here, but on that Thursday, 40,000 people gathered outside the Wisconsin Capitol, 40,000 people. That was the day the bill was supposed to pass. The only way to stop the bill was if the Republican leadership of the state Senate lacked a quorum. The only way that you took away a quorum was if every single Democratic state senator walked out. And a friend of mine, Chris Larson, a state senator from Milwaukee, said they looked out the window and they looked at the 40,000 people outside and they thought to themselves in their caucus, are we going to be cogs in a machine? Are we going to be extras in this bad movie? Are we going to help this governor take away the rights of every public employee union in this state? Or are we going to refuse to let this machine operate? And all 14 senators walked out of the Capitol because 40,000 of their constituents were standing outside that Capitol. And the next day when the state assembly was supposed to pass the bill, 50,000 people stood outside of that Capitol, and the state assembly Republicans backed off because they were afraid to advance the bill with 50,000 people outside the Capitol. And you know what? They got so scared when those Democratic senators went over the line to Illinois. They got so scared that they finally decided to pass the bill illegally. They broke the open meetings law. They violated all the rules of the legislature. They pushed the bill through. But on the night they did that, I'd been down in Kenosha, Wisconsin, down in the southeast, an old industrial town, 7,000 people out for a rally there. I came back up, raced back up to Madison. I thought, my God, they're forcing this bill through. Oh, I want to tell you the power of Facebook and Twitter. They gave less than 2 hours notice, and yet people from all over Madison raced to the Capitol. There were people who literally, mothers who ran from their homes holding their children. There were people who raced up in their car, jumped out of their car, left the door open and the car running, and ran to the Capitol. By the time the legislature acted, there were 7,000 people surrounding the Capitol, and they pushed their way into the Capitol, filling that Capitol, chanting, "Kill the bill." Now, the legislature went ahead and passed the bill. The next day, they passed, without any Democrats present, the next day, they passed the bill in the assembly, and then the governor signed it, and the New York Times, paper of record in America, said on that Friday, the fight is over, the bill has been passed. It's done, go home, be off with you. And on Saturday morning, 3 weeks ago, my daughter, who's 7 years old, and I drove down south of Madison to see my friend Joel Greeno. He's a farmer from Kendall, Wisconsin. And he had said, this is not a struggle anymore for public employees. This is a struggle for public services and public schools, and we farmers have got to be on the side of the workers. And so his farmer friends from across Wisconsin had come in this bitter cold day. One guy had done his chores at 2 a.m. so that he could drive in and be there. It took him 7 hours to come in on his old tractor. And we came down, and we finally got started. Joel got us going, all 50 tractors, and we started heading into Madison. There were about 12 kids out by the side of the road, young kids, little ones, high elementary school, with a sign that said, "Thank you, farmers." Then up the road a little bit, there's about 100 people, big banner, "Thank you, farmers." Farmers and workers together, pulled together. And we came in, and cars started pulling up alongside this cavalcade of people. And they were honking. They'd all figured out. It took them 3 weeks. We're not that fast in Wisconsin, but they had figured out how to do the chant, "This is what democracy looks like," on their car horns. Beep, 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 beep. And here they are, dozens of cars coming along. This is what democracy looks like, kept protecting the farmers as they came up the road. And we rolled up past our county courthouse up to the capital of Wisconsin. And as we rolled up, not knowing what to expect, we were greeted by 150,000 people who did not read the New York Times. They did not know the struggle was over. And we have continued to be out there every day, a mass movement that last Tuesday won the three largest county executive races in the state, candidates who supported Walker versus candidates who opposed Walker. The opponents of Walker won Milwaukee County, Dane County, Outagamie County. Incredible victories, never happened before. In our state Supreme Court race, a woman who had never run for office, who was a total unknown, who was written off as completely unviable, has wrestled one of our senior state Supreme Court justices to an absolute tie. It is a tie vote. We're going to have a recount. We're going to have a battle royale for that Supreme Court seat. Because this mass movement in Wisconsin has turned, pivoted from the streets to the ballot box. And I will close off by telling you that my friend Tim Carpenter, who is the most optimistic fool I have ever met. Tim Carpenter, for many, many years, has preached an inside-outside strategy. He says we got to be in the streets protesting with our brown bags against the war in Afghanistan, as if a little bit of lunch will stop the military-industrial complex. And then he says we got to be inside finding our political allies, like this wonderful congressman and this wonderful congressman. I think we got a great state legislator here. And this is finding our allies, working inside and outside. And that somehow if we do that, if we mass enough people in the streets, if we find our political allies, we can stop the machine of economic and corporate overlords, and we can put power back with the people. And I want to tell you this, 8 weeks after Scott Walker proposed his bill, with absolute control of the governorship of Wisconsin, absolute control of the legislature of Wisconsin, absolute control of the high courts of Wisconsin, that bill has not been implemented. That is not the law. They have not broken our unions, and it hasn't happened because of people power and inside-outside strategy, just like PDA talks about. Thank you for coming out today. We're going to have a hell of a day. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much.
When we start off the new year giving mega tax breaks to multi-billionaires, and it goes downhill from there. Then I hear in a State of the Union speech, the first place we're going to start cutting is in community service block grants, which is heating, food, education. And then I start seeing budgets that prioritize all the wrong things. I understand we're in tough times, and I think we have to be realistic about this. I will support some funding cuts that are necessary as long as they are jointly and fairly shared, which means I would vote for cuts to things that I don't want to cut. But I'm not doing that if it's only to those things. I'm not doing that if tax increases, or more importantly, they're not increases, they're just returning to what they were, if those are off the table. And I wanted to come today because I know that the people in this room, I know that the PDA, are the very people that understand when times get tough, you run towards the problem, not away from it.
Right. Right.
And when I look at a place like Wisconsin, I will tell you that for me, like everybody, I watched it grow. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying to myself, this isn't going to last. And it's not going to last because I was afraid that in some ways this country has moved beyond people actually getting up off of their couches and doing something. Prior to this, up until, well, probably since the 70s, the last big movement was a whole bunch of emails. I'm seriously concerned about the terrible thing you're about to do. And I'm doing everything I can to defeat it, thereby sending you this email. And it's strongly worded.
Capital letters.
Gee, that's all? When I saw people one step at a time, as John described, grow, get off the couch, get involved, be concerned, and make it real. That tells me something. But I want to be clear. My biggest problem here in Massachusetts, too many of us think it'll never happen here.
Yeah.
We're Massachusetts. We're all liberals. It's only a question of I'm more liberal than you. Did you miss, like, Mitt Romney? Did you miss that this state voted not once but twice for who is now, probably in the Republican Party, considered a wacko liberal, Ronald Reagan? It's not an accident. In the legislature, Republicans picked up seats in this state. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not a critical force yet. And I will tell you that my big concern is people like us. I'm disappointed in the president. I wish he had gone to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. He should have gone to Wisconsin.
Yeah. You can send the Justice Department in right now, and it's a good point.
And I can list a whole bunch of things that I'm not happy with. But, okay, does that mean I'm going to walk away next year? Or look for the perfect candidate, the third-party candidate, to be perfect? And thereby opening the door to a defeat? Does anybody here really think that there is a single Republican potential nominee that would be better than Barack Obama?
No.
So for me, my fight is not that. And those who are tempted to take that fight on are opening the doors to hell, in my opinion. But I want to be clear. That doesn't mean that we're not still trying to persuade the president to do the right thing. The way I'm doing it is my votes on the floor and my support for other members of Congress who are more likely to push him to do the right thing. If the wave comes back our way, do you think there's any doubt that the president will come back our way? None in my mind. So while I have my differences with my president, our president, my struggle is to give him the courage to do the things we want him to do. That started in Wisconsin, and as it grows through Ohio and Pennsylvania and Indiana and hopefully here in Massachusetts, one step at a time, the Congress will hear you and the president will hear you. That's why I wanted to come today. That's why I wanted
Great. To Great. Thank you. Eve. Very interesting. Now, you're here, you're in Massachusetts. Obviously, you look at national patterns. And I want to do a two-part question for you and have you get up and talk to these folks a bit. First off, I mean, you've been doing labor for a long time. Were you surprised that a labor struggle going after public employees and, you know, those horrible, highly paid public employees could actually draw a mass movement into the streets? And secondly, do you think that's something that, as the congressman has suggested, is translatable to other states and maybe taking it all over the country? And I must ask you to project.
So I never thought I would say that a right-wing Republican governor from Wisconsin was doing us all a favor, but he did us all a favor. Because what he tried to do in Wisconsin is something that's been happening all across the country, in many, many states, but it was happening little by little, right? We had a couple of cuts here and a bad bill over here and, you know, some threats to collective bargaining over here. And there are lots of unions who are mobilizing and always fighting the defensive fight, right? Trying to stop the next worst thing from happening. But it wasn't until Governor Walker proposed a bill that did everything at once that the labor movement said, you know what, this is it. We can't take it anymore. We have to stand up and fight back. And that's why he did everyone a favor, because he really took something that was a statewide struggle that's happening in lots of states, and he proposed something that was so bad that people all around the country realized we've got to take a stand. So do you know how many states right now have similar legislation proposed?
I know that Massachusetts does.
How many other? We know about Ohio, Indiana, Michigan. New Jersey, New Hampshire. There are 24 states right now. 24 states.
Let's underline that.
24
states are going to do the exact same thing.
Have legislation that either takes away people's right to bargain, takes away unions' ability to collect dues, cuts certain people out of the bargaining, out of the right to have collective bargaining. 24 states. The Los Angeles Times wrote an article last week that counted up 744 different bills that are doing the same thing. So it's not something that one governor woke up, you know, and said, I've got a great idea. Why don't I try and bust the unions in my state? It's part of a major organizing campaign that's been going on for at least 30 years, right? And until now, that campaign that was organized by the wealthiest corporations, right-wing think tanks, Republican Party, that campaign was focused on private sector unions. And it's been remarkably successful, right? When unions were at their peak, over 30% of workers in the private sector in this country were members of unions. Now, do you know what that percentage is? 7%. And the only reason you know that is because of Wisconsin and because unions have been in the news and everyone's talking about this. So they were successful at attacking private sector unions to the point that only 7% of workers are in one. Many industries, many parts of the country, people don't know what unions are and don't have the opportunity to join one. So this started a race to the bottom. Once they were able to do that, wages started going down, benefits started going down, and then the next target was the public sector. And they took the public sector and said, look, the private sector, you know, wages and benefits are so terrible, you should have terrible wages and benefits too. And so it starts this race to the bottom, and you see it happening everywhere. Someone said Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, we've got a bill that's being proposed right now that would take away the rights of K-12 teachers and municipal workers to negotiate their health benefits. No more bargaining rights over health care for municipal employees. And it's part of the same thing. They're saying, look, they have better benefits than the state workers. Why should municipal workers have such good benefits? So it starts this race to the bottom. And I think that's the thing that people are really waking up and starting to understand. It is a national movement. You know, last week on Tuesday, there was a wave of teach-ins that when they started, they came up with this idea, I think, 2 weeks ago. A bunch of people in New York said, let's have a bunch of teach-ins. And they thought, maybe we'll try and get 100 campuses around the country to do a teach-in. By Tuesday, there were 220 campuses that held teach-ins all over the U.S. We had one at UMass, and we had 1,000 students there.
Wow.
We had students, faculty, community members. We were shocked. We organized the thing, and we thought, if we can fill up all 400 seats, we'll be happy. And there was standing room and people sitting on the floor. And why is that? Because students, you know, you hear students are apathetic, they don't vote, they don't care. Students care, and they're waking up too. And they're going out into this economy, and they want to know what's happening in the world, why are things so messed up, and what can we do about it? And so at the teach-in, we were able to talk to people about single-payer health care, and why would it save so much money? What about the defense budget? And where is, you know, what is it sucking out of our economy? How do unions work? What is collective bargaining? Why is it so important? Why are we saying that you can't really have a democratic society without unions? So we were able to talk about all of those things and really start this conversation. And it's happening all over. I know I teach labor studies, and we're getting applications from students saying, you know, I want to come learn about the labor movement. It seems like that's where the action is. So in a lot of ways, you know, like Karen said, crisis is an opportunity, and this is an opportunity for a new kind of solidarity. So we've got to grab a hold of it and do it.
Hey, thank you. Michael Leidy gets it. He is a political labor activist who really does understand what all is going on. He's been incredibly supportive of the movements and the struggles long before what happened in Wisconsin. But I'll tell you something. Yes, it's worth it. I'll tell you something. In Wisconsin, that struggle's going on, and some unions are like, well, maybe we're going to have to compromise. Maybe we've got to give up our pay. Yeah, I know we only make 12 bucks an hour, but maybe we could make it on 7. Food stamps are okay. And California Nurses Association, National Nurses Association, came into Wisconsin. They represent a couple hospitals. And they came in the midst of a struggle with a campaign that said, big posters, and they're everywhere in Wisconsin now. They said, blame Wall Street, not public employees. And thousands of, the best thing they did on I think it was Fat Tuesday, they had a march, a New Orleans-style march in the middle of snow in Wisconsin, and something like 7,000 people showed up. They had a jazz band, and they marched to the Capitol, and they said, absolutely no compromise. We're not giving up benefits. We're not giving up pay. We're not giving up our union rights unless corporate America starts to pay its fair share. Please welcome the person behind this struggle, Michael Leidy.
Thank you all very much. It is really an honor to be here with Congressman Capriano and Eve, and especially John Nichols, who really is the conscience of the movement. If you've seen John's writing, if you've seen his reporting, he is the conscience of our movement. He is an inspirational thinker and a tremendous analyst and motivator. And I want to pitch his new book. I haven't even read it yet, but the Washington Post liked it.
Yeah, they're very nice.
S is for socialism.
Well, it's a history of social democracy in America.
Yeah. And I think we have a lot to learn about that. You know, we talk about the union density in this country, right? And there it is. The book is in the back room.
Yeah.
We talk about union density in this country. France has 8% union density. Mm-hmm. And they had 2.7 million people in the streets protesting the right-wing government's effort to raise the retirement age. Right, so it's not simply about membership, right? It's about the movement, it's about the politics that movement projects, and it's about how that movement organizes. And so it's really something when we are able to do in Wisconsin the unexpected. But it is, as John was saying, from our point of view, we're not gonna stand up here and say it's okay to give concessions to the Democrats. We're not gonna say that, right? That, yeah, if we simply replace those state senators who are Republicans with Democrats and we keep our union rights, sure, they can have our health benefits, they can have our pensions. And no, it ain't gonna work like that, right? And the reason for that is very simple, and it is the kind of politics we're trying to project there, is that there are other people at fault, right? And those people haven't paid. They haven't sacrificed. New York Times reported today, did you see that, right? The bankers are back, right? The bankers are back. TARP was set up to save the financial system and to save homeowners. Well, who's still drowning and who's profiting, right? So let's start there, right? Republicans want to balance the budget, rescind that extension of the tax cuts. Maybe GE, who made, what was it, $13 billion, and we in the government, the taxpayers, owe GE $3 billion, right? They paid no taxes. They want a refund from us, GE. And this is the guy, the CEO of that tax chiseler, is the head of the President's Economic Advisory Council? Ooh. What the hell is that? So I agree with you, Congressman. We're not going to go out there and say there's a better president, you know, on the Republican side, right? But there is not an electoral solution. We're not going to go out there and form a third party. There's not an electoral solution. There is a movement solution.
Yes.
There is an organizing solution. Right?
My God,
and yes, and if we had senators, right,
yes,
who are truly progressive, then we can start making a difference. Because it is true, Bernie Sanders is in the Senate, right, and he is making a difference, right? And it is much tougher as a Congress member or even a caucus in the House, particularly when the other party controls it, right? We know the difficulties of that, right? We know the limitations of that. I was just with Barbara Lee last night, right? And she, as some of us were talking, has moved the DNC to a position of get out of Afghanistan, right? Yeah. The Democratic National Committee on record as getting out of Afghanistan. That's a huge win, right? And And at the same time, she, of course, had to battle the White House and battle even, you know, members of her party. And so we are the troops behind that struggle. Now, when I'm a little scared this week because the president's going to start talking about Medicare and Medicaid, right? And the problem I got with that is that we were in a situation around the healthcare fight where we accepted the premise that we're going to have some kind of private insurance-based system, and that we're going to have to reform that system, but only on the lines of private insurance, right? So we fragmented we continue to fragment the system, right? And it's based on ability to pay. The more money you got, the better health plan you're going to be able to afford, right? And then we're going to put those 133% or less of the federal poverty line, they're going to go into Medicaid. And then we're going to keep the elderly in a program. And we know that the elderly use more health care. That's the nature of aging. We know that 20% of the people in this country take about 80% of the healthcare spending, and we know they're concentrated in Medicare. How can you save Medicare if it only covers the sickest? You can't. You cannot. So you can reform payment schemes, you can talk about entitlement reform, but unless you put everybody into one system,
yes.
You cannot solve the problem. Right? So the president has another opportunity. The president has another opportunity to say, you're right, we're going to fix Medicare. You know how we're going to fix Medicare? We're all in this together. We're not going to make seniors. By the time that Representative Ryan's reform were to be in place, seniors would bear two-thirds of the cost of health care.
True.
Of their own health care, right? By the time that program were fully implemented, seniors would be on the hook. And we're not and they're going to go out there and they're going to say to folks who are 55 and older, don't worry, you're fine. It's just the rest of us, right, who are going to have that system. And that system's going to mean that the same way that seniors were impoverished before 1965, they will be impoverished again. And so this is our challenge, right? To build that movement that says, okay, we're not going to let the president define what's politically possible in this country. He's got his own imperatives. He's got his reelection. But we are going to build that mass movement. And nurses are going to be a fundamental part of it. And we're going to say we've developed this Main Street contract for the American people, right? And we're going to go out there on that platform of health care and jobs, justice. And that's the movement we can build. And it is national. We were just with staff from Massachusetts, and we had this discussion, exactly what you're saying, Congressman, can it happen in Massachusetts? It can happen in California, and the Democrats control every office in the state, right? So it can happen anywhere, and that's why we're all in this together. So I'm so proud to be here. Thank you.
Michael. Movement. Politics. Now, in 1934, Franklin Roosevelt came to Wisconsin. And he gave a speech in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And they thought he was going to recognize the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate and the Democratic candidate for governor. Instead, he said, I want to note my friends Robert M. La Follette, Jr. and Phil La Follette, the leaders of the Wisconsin Progressive Party, because they're more progressive than the Democrats here on the stage. And he's a good Democrat. Roosevelt was a good Democrat. But the point he was making was that sometimes a political party has to become a movement force, a progressive force. And this congressman has done all the work. I got nothing to ask of you. Yeah, okay, out of here, mister. But your vote... And I know there's probably somebody here who can find a vote he did wrong, and I know that. But I'm going to tell you that this is a guy, when I look at, I cover Congress for a living, I got no trouble with this guy. I'm getting plenty of good votes out of him. But how do we make the Democratic Party into a force that can actually, a very blunt political question, not an ideological question, that can seize what to me seems like a moment, that can actually, you know, go into these swing states like Ohio and Michigan and Indiana and Wisconsin and grab hold of this people power and turn it into some kind of force?
I actually like that question, because when I talk to groups like this, it's not about ideology. We're pretty much at least in the same chapter, if not necessarily on the same page. And I make a joke about it all the time. The people that I'm not worried about are the people who are not only reading different books, but they don't know what the library is, and if they found it, they'd want to burn it down. So that's my concern. And the truth is, I can't change their mind.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about it. And I don't hate them. I don't denigrate them. It doesn't matter. I actually respect them. The Tea Party people that are up there in Washington all the time, I don't get angry about them. The truth is, my problem is with my friends who want perfection all the time. I'll give you a classic example. I'm going to name a guy, too. A couple of years ago, when Democrats took the Congress, some of my progressive friends immediately started talking about running more progressive members against Democrats. It's like, what are you talking about? And I'll give you an example. Gene Taylor from Mississippi, Mississippi 1st District, the most conservative Democrat in the House for years, only voted with the Democrats about 50% of the time. Well, we got our wish. He's gone. But he's been replaced by a Republican who votes with us 0% of the time. And it is highly likely we will never get that seat back. So what did we win? We won nothing by seeking perfection. We cannot have progressives, true progressives, in every seat. We have to make hard political judgments. Yes, it is good in a Democratic primary to support the most progressive person we can find who can win. That's a judgment call. People will have different opinions. I respect that. Mm-hmm. But to support somebody because they're perfect, knowing they can't win, is a disservice to the things you really believe, in my opinion. Because we cannot make progress on the basis of idealism alone. We have to make progress. Yes, it is a movement, but the movement is the result, or is the beginning. The result is political leadership. The Tea Party has figured this out. The Tea Party has figured this out. There was a time when we weren't sure what they were going to do. They got smart. And I wish they weren't. They're inside the Republican Party.
Yeah, very much.
I will tell you, without question, the Republicans in the House are not all that conservative. Mm-hmm. Some are, some are not. There are some very potentially, not progressive, but as progressive as you're going to get, Republicans in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And you know who I mean.
I do know.
But they can't vote with us. Because if they do, first of all, you have to understand, politics is not an individual sport. It is a group sport. You cannot be on your own all the time. Otherwise, you will render yourself irrelevant. So you have to find places to get in line with other people. It's a team sport. That's number one. Number two is on that side. If you step out of line, they will take things away and hurt you, hurt your constituents, and they have done it. Repeatedly, including the man I'm talking about in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. They have denied him the opportunity to move up where he deserved to do so.
That's right.
Because he didn't get in line. So what I say to you is yes, that is a, I think that's the best question you can ask. The ideology we can fight all day long, exactly where the commas belong, what should be in the platform, exactly how I should vote on vote number 487. But the truth is, it doesn't matter if we don't have a chance in a majority. And the way we get a chance of the majority is remembering how Franklin Roosevelt got elected and people like him. He got elected from old-fashioned machine politics.
He did. Yeah.
Now, I'm not suggesting we go back to those days, but I am suggesting that when we do our political work, we get real about it. We don't hold people to a standard that only I or only you could handle. We hold them to the standard of reality. Who can get elected in this district, in this state? Who will come closest to us, who will work with us, who at least won't get in the way. And I think that too many of my friends have forgotten the fact that in politics, you have to be tough. And you have to make hard decisions. Not perfect decisions. And I'll talk about it right now. Maybe I shouldn't. This Senate fight we're about to have. You tell me, the realism. Can a Democrat win this election if we, now remember, we have a late primary, a September primary, the latest primary in the country. Can you in 7 weeks pull together the Democratic Party, attract independents, and raise $10 million? Not 30 cents, $10 million in 7 weeks to win this election?
Yes.
I think the answer is no.
No.
I think the answer is no. If we go through a bloody, if we go through a bloody primary and you wake up the next day, where's the smart money going to go? Where does smart money go?
Well, ah, there you go.
Thanks. Smart money goes to where they think they can win. It is a pure, cold-hearted decision. So for me, I think if we want to win this seat, not just this seat, this is nothing more than an example. The same holds true in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all the time. We lost the governorship in Pennsylvania this past election because we had an incredibly difficult Democratic primary. The guy who won couldn't put it together in the final analysis. And that's a state that we need to win. We need to win that. We lost the Ohio governorship for the same reason. We have to get smarter in our political approach so that we can have a hope of getting closer to our ideological hopes. That's my opinion. I know it's cold-blooded. I know that some people don't want to hear it because it doesn't fit in Chapter 42 of Political Science 101. But that's a result of 40 years on the street trying to win elections and change people's mind. And it may be a wrong conclusion, and I know some people may not agree with it, but even if you don't agree with that, the concept is still true. Politics matters, elections matter, and we're suffering the consequences of that now.
Brian Capuano. What that guy just said, right? It could be so much easier to stand in front of you and tell you, oh yeah, we can do whatever we want. It's the dream we'll win, right? He's talking hard politics. You can disagree with him. You can fight him on it, and, I might back you. Who knows? But I will tell you this. Always look for a politician that, when you know the easy answer, doesn't give you the easy answer. Very valuable thing. Now, we're running down. We don't have a lot of time. I got one quick thing I got to do. IBEW member, who also happens to be a state representative, Paul Mark. Where are you, Paul? There you go. I like you. That may be the answer right there. Right? Right? The president of the Labor Center at UMass Amherst. Yeah. Maybe the answer is to put more union people into elected office. We ran through a lot of time here. We're kind of winding down, but I want to give Eve and Michael just a minute to kind of come off and riff for a second off what our congressman has said about turning this street movement into an election matters, elections can be won movement. So Eve, why don't you take a shot at that?
You know, all I'll say is that just like what we saw in Wisconsin, the political possibilities change when the movement changes. When people mobilize and organize and make clear what they're willing to do, when teachers are willing to walk out and graduate students move into the state house and they're supported by farmers on tractors, and it's clear that the same people who we think of as the Tea Party types are now supporting the right to organize and the rights of public sector workers, politics changes and what's possible changes. We hear this all the time from politicians in Massachusetts. You know, we have to look at the realities. And yes, there are realities, but the realities have been defined for us in such narrow terms that sometimes we have to be willing to say, you know what, I don't accept those terms, and I want to look at what one example in Massachusetts right now, there's a bill called the Act to Invest in Our Communities that's being pushed by the unions, It does a lot of what we've been talking about. It really addresses inequality by bringing tax rates back to what they used to be, back up to what they used to be, and then it gives exemptions for people who make less than $60,000 so that they actually would get a tax cut, while people at the very top would get a tax increase and would actually pay their share. These are the kinds of bills that also are, you know, in states everywhere that unions are pushing. And the politicians always start out by saying, oh, that's not possible. People don't want that. People aren't for that. Well, you know what? That's what they said in Wisconsin, too. And then when the polls came out a couple weeks after people took over the state house and they said, would you rather see your taxes go up or would you rather see public employees get their jobs and benefits cut? People said, I'd rather raise my taxes. Mm-hmm. It shocked people. People, you know, they're not for unions. They don't really know anything about unions, but they said, yeah, there's something really wrong here that we're looking at these people as the problem, when we know that the top 10th of 1% are the people who have gotten richer over the past decade, while everyone else is not going anywhere. People get it. And so when you can mobilize around these things, when there's a movement to make it clear, then the realities change.
Coming right off from Michael Lighty.
Thank you, John. I don't disagree with that there are going to be, and we see this, you know, in California, we see it all over the country, there are going to be some seats that true progressives can't win, right? What we've got to do, I think, is we've got to have a program around which we organize to then hold the elected officials accountable, right? So it starts with programs first, right? So that's why we're talking about this Main Street contract. Inequality is the issue of our time. The top 10% of this country control two-thirds of the net worth, right, in terms of money. The average hourly wage for a worker has gone up, I think it's since 1978, it's about 79 cents an hour, right, in inflation, you know, accounting for inflation, right? And so the question is, the other side is taking this to core principles. Taxation is theft, right? Entitlements are wrong, you're on your own. What the state should do is fund the military and protect our national interests, and everything else is secondary, right? That they're taking it to first principles. We will lose that fight if we simply negotiate on their terms, right? If they say we have a deficit problem because of spending, and we say, okay, we're going to cut, we've already lost the fight, right? So that's where it starts. It starts with jobs at living wage, quality education. How is it that that guy, Chris, I want to refer to him as Chris Christie's in New Jersey, can build his national career on the backs of teachers?
Enough teachers. Yes.
How is that even possible? Right? It is morally wrong. Right? And so it is also the union's responsibility to go out there. And the labor movement has been deficient too. I saw a recent summary of discussions at the AFL-CIO Executive Committee. Their program is to refine their polling. And I'm not kidding about this. They polled in advance. You know this, John.
I know.
They polled in Wisconsin and they determined that, and this is precisely why John, what you were saying, right, about that discussion, they determined that the public wasn't with them, right? That's why they polled it and said, the public isn't going to support public sector collective bargaining, so we got to figure out another way to pitch it, right? And then they realized the alternative. And they have a program, Working America, going door to door in Wisconsin, talking to mostly working class voters. And they go to them and they say, well, they've got their polling messages, and they say, we're here to help save the middle class. And the workers at the door say, who the hell are you talking about? I'm about to lose my home. I can barely afford groceries. I ain't middle class. Who are you talking about?
That's right.
Right? And so we've lost our way. We've lost our way. And this convergence of narrow-minded political consultants, right, parsing a program in order to slice the electorate in their favor, versus building a movement based upon the fundamental needs of this country and going to first principles around which side are you on, I choose the movement.
Well, I'm gonna let you in on a joke from Wisconsin. You know why Wisconsin went so well? Because Walker, the governor, moved so quickly that the movement had to start before the folks in Washington had come up with their talking points. So we did it on our own. We did it with our talking points. And you know what? I have seen something amazing. I have seen 65-year-old grandmothers in their Christmas sweaters. And you know, if you're not from the Midwest, you may not know the magic of a Christmas sweater. There you go, but it is, you know, you got a reindeer on it, right? I have seen 65-year-old grandmothers in their Christmas sweaters standing next to pierced teenagers with their spiked and dyed hair, with their fists in the air together, shouting, an injury to one is an injury to all. And let me tell you, that is a lot more powerful than I'm here to help the middle class. And so the fact is, there are lessons to be taken from that. There's some tremendous lessons to be taken from Michael Leidy, from Eve Weinbaum, and from, now I'm not even saying this guy's name, you guys, is there any last message for this congressman from the crowd? Anything you want to say? Thank you. Thanks to our panel. Thanks very much.